SBS کوردی روجنینی ششه وار روجن یکشمه دوی دونیورو یان گهلدانا بریا اینترنت دما دخوازی
Jorge Aroche, President of International Rehabilitation Council for Torture Survivors and CEO of New South Wales Services for Treatment of and Rehabilitation of Torture and Trauma Survivors, starts. Welcome to SBS Radio.
Thank you, Rosa.
Thank you. On Tuesday, it was the UN International Day in support of victims of torture, and you ran an event in Sydney's Town Hall where a panel discussed the topic about dangerous times and perspective on torture, shifting global politics and respect for human rights. If you could firstly give us an overview and a perspective about how dangerous the times and the era that we live in is for human rights in general on a global scale.
It's a complex time globally. Mm-hmm. I think over the last few years, things have been shifting. We've seen more populist leaders with strong nationalistic tendencies and very inward-looking, taking a government in many countries, starting, you know, with Trump, of course, but, you know, we see similar patterns in Hungary, in Turkey, continuation of totalitarian regimes in Egypt. Now Italy's also got, you know, very conservative anti-immigration, anti-refugee government with, you know, quite problematic stances on these issues. Mm-hmm. And in a sense, you know, this lack of I suppose, concern for human rights as an important issue to take up by many global leaders, you know, from the West, have given, you know, tacit permission, you know, to many leaders in countries with, you know, fledging democracies and historically problematic stances in terms of torture to begin to see that maybe it is again okay to use more repressive measures against these populations to, you know, keep them in check, and to begin to use or continue to use torture more. So it is a dangerous time in terms of human rights, where we're seeing us going backwards in places. Mm-hmm. For example, Turkey is a very good example where there have been tremendous changes and a lot of progress in terms of eradicating torture, with the military, the judicial system, and police all engaged in recognizing that torture was something highly problematic, and that really engage in measures to try and eradicate it. And, you know, the work there is now going backwards. I mean, it's not like that everywhere. You know, there's many bright spots, but I think it's a worrying time.
Mm-hmm. You have launched a campaign now in support of victims of torture, which is initiated by IRCT. Could you tell us a little bit about this new campaign?
It really is what we call, you know, the global fundraising campaign, Australian Pilot. Mm-hmm. One of the problems with the network of torture and trauma services around the world that assist survivors to you know, be able to have a life after torture, is that they have, I mean, as you can imagine, in most countries where torture has taken place, governments, even after a transition process, are quite reluctant, you know, to fund services to assist torture and trauma survivors. So that means that in many parts of the world, torture and trauma services depend on the goodwill of other governments, sometimes directly through different collaboration and partnership programs, and sometimes through tools such as the UN Voluntary Funds against torture. What we've seen in the last few years is a lot of this money has been drying up. That means that in a context in which we have more torture and trauma survivors than ever, torture and trauma survivors tend to be roughly, you know, a proportion, you know, that has remained constant, you know, when you look at displaced people in general. Mm-hmm. And the figures about displaced people continue to be on the rise. You know, they've risen about 3 million to, you know, a height of, you know, 86.5, I think it is, million this year. 68.5. And that means that in a context where these services are needed more than ever, the funds to run them are dwindling. Several services, you know, I think four or five, are closed during the last year, and many are on the brink of disappearing. So we've come to the conclusion at the RCT that we need to change the business model, you know, that sustains torture and trauma services, and that we need to stop relying just on governments for an aid budgets and develop, you know, a more direct way in which people around the world who are concerned for victims of torture will see that in addition to eradicating torture as a long-term goal, we need to focus on the short-term immediate goal of assisting victims of torture to have a life. And so we're starting a campaign, you know, to make it possible for basically civil society, normal people like you and me, to be able to donate small amounts of money that go to our funds that then can be distributed to torture and trauma services around the world that need it in order to ensure that they, you know, their work is able to be continued.
Mm. So on an individual level, how important is the rehabilitation process and the services that we're talking about here for the survivors of torture and trauma?
They're incredibly important. This is something that came through very strongly in the discussion of the panel. Sekai Holland spoke about her own torture, her own process of rehabilitation, in which that's, you know, played a very important part, and how without, you know, those services, without that assistance, she would not have been able to go back to politics as she did. She would not have been able to go back, you know, to continue to be one of the foremost African progressive leaders and activists. And, of course, the pathway is different from everyone. But for many people, luckily not all, but roughly we've established about 30% of people that are subjected, you know, to extremes of trauma in a context of organized violence. And of course, the most extreme example would be torture, suffer consequences that affect, you know, how, you know, their brain is able to process things, that affect, you know, the memory, their ability to focus, their ability to sleep, their ability to rest, their ability to trust other people. It changes the way that they see the world, but also for many changes the way that they can manage their own internal resources, you know, the way they think, in a sense. When you are confronted with these changes after torture, it is easy for people to think, you know, that it will always be that way, that, you know, they will never be able to go back, you know, to being, you know, the person they were before torture. What we found, you know, through many, many years of work with Stats, has been around for 30 years now.
Yeah.
It's our anniversary this year. And our colleagues overseas, you know, have found the same, is that provided, you know, we use the right approaches, we are able to assist people, you know, regain their previous level of functioning, and more importantly, regain, you know, the capacity to have a life in dignity, and a life that can be fulfilling, and a life in which they can, you know, relate, you know, to other people. And look, people will always carry the scars of what they've gone through. But it's a difference between living a life that, you know, will forever be marred by those scars, and ones where they can carry those scars in dignity, but also sometimes even become something more than what they were before. We've seen lots of change, you know, examples of people that, you know, have, after surviving torture, have gone on to forge lives, you know, of incredible service to humanity. People, you know, like Mandela, like Bachelet, you know, like Sekai, Holland herself, like Pepe Mujica, the ex-president of Uruguay. And these things are possible, but only for many people, sadly, only if they're able to be assisted at the beginning of that process.
Mm-hmm. And with the last couple of years and the increase of humanitarian intake into Australia, we know that many refugees have been accepted into Australia from Syria and Iraq. And I can give you an example of the Yazidi people, the Kurdish-speaking Yazidi people, who have arrived in Australia. It must be a busy time for you at Starts, for example. And how has your services changed or altered to accommodate the needs and the kind of rehabilitation process for these people?
Look, it has been incredibly busy indeed.
Mm.
Over the last few years, roughly we tend to see between 4,000 and 6,000 people that we're able to assist through different programs. During last financial year, we saw over 9,000, so almost double. So clearly, the demand of service increased very sharply in the context of the additional intake. We also need to take into account that over the last 3 years, we've progressed from an intake of 13,750, that's the normal intake, to 16,750, and now next financial year will be the quota for the refugee and special humanitarian program has increased to 18,750. Mm-hmm. So clearly demand has been in the rise, and it's meant that we had to increase staffing levels. 2 years ago, we had to open new offices. We opened a new office in Fairfield to our Karama office. We've also increased the size of our office in Wagan. We've opened a new office in Wollongong, and also now opening a new office in Army that we, as you may know, many Yazidi people will be settling. Some have settled there already. It's also, I suppose, the challenges of providing service to torture and trauma survivors have also been complicated by the fact that now with more refugees are settling in rural and regional areas. This in itself is a positive trend, but of course, from a service provider point of view, it does present, with challenges.
Sure. Well, Jorge Aroche, President of IRCT and CEO of STATS, we thank you so much for your time and all the insight you provided us.
Thank you, Rosa. It's a pleasure to be with you, Lily.
Like SBS Radio, Bashir Kurdin.